Allah, we must conduct and implement and practice this servitude of Allah so much to the extent that Imam Khomeini says we must do this, even if it is with a limping leg. And so, dear friends, sometimes in our lives, we can't run, spiritually speaking, as fast as we want. Sometimes we have highs and sometimes we have lows. Sometimes we want to do the nawafil, the supurgatory prayers. We want to do extra dhikr, remembrance of Allah. We want to do extra good actions. Sometimes we don't want to do that extra good in our lives. And on the contrary, sometimes we refrain from doing evil deeds, we refrain from committing sins, but sometimes we take a misstep and we commit a sin. Here we ask for forgiveness from Allah and remember, as Imam Khomeini said, that on the path of ubudiyyah, on the path of the servitude of Allah, continue to walk that path with patience and determination and steadfastness, even if it is with a limping leg. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Sometimes in my conversation with people, in my talks and what comes in my inbox and just kind of overhearing some people, I get the sense that, you know, they believe that the deen doesn't have any room for anxiety and stress. Doesn't even accept the fact that a believer should feel anxious and stressed at any time. That at all times there should be a level of serenity, a level of contentment, a level of, you know, this nirvana, this flying, this, just this sense of calmness about them that, you know, no matter what the dunya throws at them, you know, doesn't affect them at all. And if we adopt that incorrect philosophy, if we actually begin to think like that, that any moment of stress or anxiety, we're bound to equate that to the fact that not only am I not handling this properly, but my faith is low as well. One of the most beautiful things that we have in our arsenal of outlets is dua. It's dua. This treasure of dua. You know, Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam talks about the philosophy of dua. And by the way, the Ahl al-Bayt are those individuals, that family, that beautiful treasure of ours that not only taught us the beauty of dua, but left the actual words behind for us to say this on this day at this time of the day. These are the words you are to repeat. One such thing that he mentions, Imam Sajjad, it's a very beautiful concept. He says that when you do dua, when you actually ask Allah for something, don't just assume that God knows what's inside your heart. He does, obviously. He says to verbalize the dua, speak the dua. Allow your ears to hear the dua come out of your mouth. When that happens, the ear being the ear of the soul, or that avenue of the soul, it goes right back to the soul. Says, look, this individual now is expressing their hajat or their desire, their dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When the ear hears the mouth ask Allah, the ear becomes stronger in its iman, and because it's a path of the soul gets stronger. Right. And in the process now, when you believe that you have Allah there to lessen your anxiety and lessen your stress, it becomes a little bit more bearable. It becomes a little bit more bearable. So find your outlet. Have an outlet. Don't assume that it's okay. It's buried inside of me. It was a long time ago. I've forgotten about it. When one day you wake up all of a sudden, you can't describe or you can't even identify why my body right now is going through all of this until you actually talk about it. When you talk about it, all of a sudden all the symptoms go away one by one because now you're addressing those things inside of you. You know, the story of Nabi Musa alayhi salam is a beautiful one. One of the areas is that when he flees Egypt and goes towards the city called Madian, right, in the south of Syria, 8 days this prophet of God was making his way without food, without water, without any money, nothing, eating leaves off the trees and whatever wild fruits he could find, to the point when he got to the actual city, his feet were bleeding from the blisters and the walking. But he arrived there with a sense of, like, he left Egypt with a sense of fear, not knowing what's going to happen to him, awaiting that you know, Pharaoh is going to capture him, right? And because he killed that Egyptian by mistake, he's going to go ahead and he's going to kill me because of it, because he was an Egyptian himself, Pharaoh. The amount of fear, the level of khawf that the Quran describes Nabi Musa as having throughout this entire time of when he killed the Egyptian by mistake to when he left Egypt itself, it just talks about the fact that he was in this disarray, this level of anxiety and stress, right? And that's just part of this dunya. It's going to happen. It's going to keep happening. And we cannot expect the dunya to change. We have to change our approach to the dunya. And as I've oftentimes said, sometimes that hardship, that stress, that anxiety that comes our way is a prime opportunity for me to take that and convert it into worship for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But let's not deny the fact that part of the idea of me resolving that spiritual stress and anxiety is to address those things from the back, from my past, that I think have long been gone. It's buried deep into, oh, this was years ago. Say it, who cares now? No, it doesn't work like that. Sometimes we don't understand. It's buried inside us. It's going to creep up one day and affect us in ways that we can't imagine. Ilahana, ma'adalak, malika kun liman malak, labayka qad, labaytu lak.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. سبحانه ما أعظم والملك لا شريك له لبيك إن الحمد لك والعز لا شريك له
In the limelight.
It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country, and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Stephen H. Wolf, author. This article is published under the heading, COVID-19 pandemic may be winding down, but Americans are still sick and dying. Stay tuned for more. It's no accident that the United States of America experienced more COVID-19 deaths in 2020 than any other country and one of the world's highest per capita death rates. We can and should blame the nation's bungled response, but a U.S. health disadvantage predates and extends far beyond COVID-19. Unless we understand and address the root causes of what's ailing Americans, the American people will continue to experience greater illness and early death for years to come. In 2013, Americans led a cross-national study for the National Research Council and Institute of Medicine. The report U.S. Health in International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, documented how Americans, even the most advantaged ones, are less healthy and dying earlier compared to people in other rich nations. Evidence of a large and growing U.S. health disadvantage extends back to 1980s and persists to this day. U.S. life expectancy dropped below the OECD average in 1998 and has since fallen further behind. By 2010, the life expectancy of Americans stopped improving altogether, plateauing until 2014 and then decreasing for three consecutive years. While it continued to climb in peer nations, by 2018, the U.S. ranked 46th in life expectancy worldwide, according to the World Bank. With the arrival of COVID-19 in late 2019, its global spread in 2020 and its devastating effects on human mortality, life expectancy was bound to fall in many nations. But the extent of the decline in the U.S. has been shocking. A recently published study co-authored with Ryan Masters shows that in 2020, U.S. life expectancy plunged 1.9 years, a drop not seen since the Second World War. This decline was 8.5 times greater than the average experienced by 16 other high-income nations, further widening cross-national life expectancy gap. In American communities of color, the drop was even more alarming. Compared to a decrease of 1.4 years among white Americans, life expectancy among Black and Hispanic Americans fell 3.3 years and 3.9 years, respectively. Years of progress in narrowing Black-white mortality gap were erased, and the Hispanic population, which has historically enjoyed longer life expectancy than whites, saw that advantage almost entirely erased. Unfortunately, data limitations prevented scientists from estimating changes for other important groups, including Native Americans, whose health and survival rates are among the worst in the nation. So how can this country prevent these excess deaths? Certainly not by spending more on healthcare, given that Americans already outspend every other country and still die prematurely. Healthcare, while essential, accounts for no more than 20% of health outcomes. The solutions extend beyond medicine. Epidemiologists, public health experts, and social scientists have long understood that their living conditions, the so-called social detriment of health, determine whether they live long, healthy, productive lives. The risk for disease and injury are strongly influenced by education, income, housing, neighborhoods, and workplaces, of course. Living conditions that preserve health and promote well-being are simply lacking for too many Americans. Against a backdrop of growing income and wealth inequality, many families go without essential resources and basic protections, including education and training, good jobs, steady income, safe and affordable housing, and community services to help families raise children and support youth, older adults, and people with disabilities. A new National Academies report found that death rates are increasing among Americans in the prime of life. At ages 25 to 64, when many are working, raising children, and caring for dependents, This means that, in addition to the many other challenges they face, American children and youth are now more likely to lose a parent and need bereavement care. The implications of these trends for families, communities, employers, and nations' economy and national security are enormous, but the solutions are no mystery. Curbing the decline in health of Americans requires adequate and equitable investments in children, education, jobs that pay a living wage, and affordable housing. Health depends on conditions outside the door, such as clean air, green space, strong social networks and services for individuals and families with social, economic, and health needs. What distinguishes other countries with better health outcomes are sensible and equitable investments in people and places. And racial inequities have haunted this nation for generations. Let's be clear, it's racism, not race, that drives racial health disparities such as higher death rates from COVID-19 and dozens of other diseases. The steep declines in the survival of black and brown Americans that study reports are not explained by skin color, but instead reflect the systematic racism that permeates almost every aspect of life in this country, including health. People discomfited by the notion of systematic racism often blame its victims for lacking personal responsibility, but racial disparities are less about the choices people make than the choices society gives them. The end of the pandemic will bring relief to many Americans, but it will not end America's health and survival crisis. The good news is that solving the U.S. health disadvantage does not require a new slate of policy proposals, but a greater focus on those currently under debate. Policies to create jobs, expand infrastructure, invest in human capital, and address systematic racism will do more to address the U.S. health disadvantage than anything doctors or hospitals might do. The reverse is also true. Failure to act, not building an economy for the 21st century centered on people and justice, will condemn American children to shorter lives and poorer health, and diminish the future of the entire country.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Salaamu alaykum, dear listeners. Welcome to another show of Islamic Upbringing. As you know, we were talking about one of the questions that we had about Islamic upbringing. Please do go on and listen to our programs if you've missed any of them. In the previous program, Brother Miqdad, welcome. You talked about the child being able to make decisions himself, itself, his, herself, and basically being a go-doer. You know, they don't wait for other people to approve what they do and what they think. And certain other things. So we're basically in the diagnosis of the signs of confidence and self-confidence phase right now. Do you have more points that can help us diagnose these things?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me mention maybe another one or two, and then we can move on to the next, the more practical stuff on how to work on self-confidence in children.
Sure.
So another sign of confidence or lack of is being able to defend oneself. Oneself or one's possession or one's identity. So children with lack of confidence, they're actually pushovers, basically.
Yeah, okay.
If something is taken from them, they're not ready to defend it. If something bad is said about them, they're not really, they're just going to take it on board, basically. Yes, you're right. This was this bad thing that you mentioned about me. I actually deserve it.
Wow.
They're not going to defend things that are precious to them. So, for example, if you say bad things to them about something that they like, something that they enjoy, or something that is precious to them, whether it's their parents, whether it's their country, their football team.
Even color, you know, my favorite color.
Exactly.
They might change your favorite color because someone else doesn't like it.
Exactly. So, a very much lack of confidence is an inability to defend oneself or one's possession or one's precious things. On the other side, a person with confidence is a person who has a very strong identity, a very strong self of possession over their own things. So a child with confidence would defend their things and would actually go about and even sometimes get injured for it.
Right.
If a bully takes my things, for example, I don't care if you're a bully, I'll go and fight.
Yeah, I'm getting back.
Even though I get hurt, because it's my thing.
Yeah.
Nobody touches my thing.
Right.
And nobody touches my parents, nobody says bad things about my country or my football team or what I like. So children who have confidence, they're ready to defend. Even if it takes risk, even if it takes danger, they're ready to take on board because they find that they have worth in themselves, they have esteem in themselves, and
nice.
That which is attached to themselves also has worth. It's my thing, it has a lot of value to me.
Yeah, so I'm worth being defended and my things are worth the defense that I provide. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. So this is a sign of confidence, and the lack of is also a sign of lack of confidence. Move on to that one. Another sign is arrogance and lack of arrogance. So
weird. Okay.
This is a very interesting one. So children with confidence, with self-confidence, are actually children that are going to be very humble.
And no way.
Yes,
okay,
very humble.
I thought it was quite opposite. Okay.
And very respectful to others. Because you see, they don't need to show off anything about themselves because they've got enough confidence in them. They've got enough self-worth in them. I don't need to be
put someone down for myself to be shown
exactly
as superior. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. It's children who have a lack of confidence that need to step on other people to be able to find themselves worth it.
They give themselves an ego boost. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So children who don't have confidence would actually put others down so that they are shown, so that they can see themselves, so they can portray themselves as having worth because they eliminate everybody else. So arrogance actually stems from a lack of confidence. A person who doesn't count himself as important, a child who doesn't see himself or herself as worth it, would actually be arrogant, put other people down.
I do have a question over here, but if you allow, we go for a short break and we return. And
sure.
Please stay tuned, dear listeners.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio @irib.ir.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about Islamic upbringing, of course. So, brother, I had a question. You remember you said in one of the programs that the child with confidence, he does not need approval, right? And even if you praise them, they'll be like, all right, fine, thank you. But doesn't that like sort of go around the lines of arrogance that is a sign of not being confident?
Right. So arrogance, it's a good question. So arrogance is when you put other people down, right? Arrogance is to say, I am better than others, okay? This is very different from not needing other people's praise, right? If I have enough confidence in me, and this confidence is in a way that is, I know my worth, I know my skills, I know my ability, and I also know my limits as well. A person who has confidence will also understand that I have limits as well. I'm able to do certain things. I'm not able to do certain things. So praise.
Right, they're realistic, you mean?
Exactly, they're realistic. So when you praise them, it's not that they put it over and say, "Oh, I am greater than what you're saying."
Yeah.
It's not saying that. It's rather saying that this doesn't have impact on my motivation. It doesn't. It's not going to make me do things because you praise me. I knew what I am. I know my worth. I know how much I can do. I know how much I can't do.
And I'll keep on doing it. Besides,
exactly, I'm driven by something other than your praise.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Arrogant people are driven because they don't have this self worth. They always count themselves as unworthy or lacking something. Or
hence,
not
pushing down other people, putting
exactly.
them down.
Exactly. They feel that they need to put other people down so that they can actually have some sort of worth.
Right.
We have in our traditions, for instance, from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, it is reported that he says that قَالَ مَا مِن رَجُلٍ تَكَبَّرَ أَوْ تَجَبَّرَ إِلَّا لِذِلَّةٍ وَجَدَهَا فِي نَفْسِهِ.
Right.
It's a very powerful sentence from the sixth holy Imam. He says that you won't find a person who does takabbur, who portrays arrogance, or tajabbara, counts himself as greater, wants to put himself forward as bigger than others,
right?
Except that they found within themselves a dhilla, that they saw within their own self a lack, a
right.
unworthiness, right?
So there's a sense of inferiority within them.
Exactly. When they count themselves as inferior than others, they feel that I need to put others lower than me so that I can have some sort of
superiority.
Exactly.
Imaginary superiority.
Rather, a person with iman, with trust, with confidence in themselves, with an awareness of their own worth, they give a lot of respect to others. They give a lot of esteem to others because they don't need to put other people down to find their own self. They already know how much they're worth, and they already have enough confidence in themselves. And actually, because of this, it leads them to respect others more, to give other people a helping hand, to actually
help other people grow.
Exactly. They work together. They're more likely to work together. They're more likely to be part of a team. They have this humility within themselves because they know their own place. They all know how much beneficial they are. They know that I need others as well as we need to grow together.
Yeah, social human beings are social after all. Yeah,
exactly. So as a sign, and you can see this in children as well, as one of the signs of confidence and lack of how much respect they give to others, how much they don't necessarily need to compare themselves with others or put others down that I'm
for
better
them
than this
themselves
person.
To feel better.
Exactly.
Sorry, I kept you with my question from moving on with the topic, and it's time for another break. So please stay tuned and we'll be back after a short break.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, excessive blame causes the fire of obstinacy to flame.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're here with Brother Miqdad discussing the signs of confidence and the lack of. Brother, you talked about children putting other people down, and well, you mentioned the tradition of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that addresses everyone, not just children, putting people down because they feel inferior. You had another point, I guess.
Right. before we move on, I guess because we've got one last part of the show left, maybe we can talk about one or two more signs and then move on, inshallah, in the next session. One other thing that's very interesting is people who, now adults more or children as well, who have a lack of confidence would actually have more desire for this world, for mundane things, right?
Right.
Let me put it this way. The world is something that gives us a very temporary amount of pleasure, a very temporary amount of perfection, right? The pleasure that we receive from this world is very short, sometimes a couple of minutes, a couple of hours, and it just goes on. And it usually has a lot of pain with it as well, right? A lot of efforts. A person who doesn't have enough confidence, they actually satisfy themselves with things that are very shallow, very lowly, basically, because they don't have enough worth. I'm not worth anything. I'm a failure.
Okay.
And
okay.
Therefore, they would be like, I'll be satisfied with very small things.
With whatever I have, you know. Exactly. I'm good. Like,
And the dunya is like this. Yeah. The desires of this world are like this.
So that's different from being content with what you have. That's be doing with the less that you have.
Exactly.
Not,
yeah.
You know, right.
So this is not contentment. This is actually going for things that are very low pleasures, basically.
Because you're undervaluing yourself.
Exactly. And it all comes back to understanding your worth. So children or adults who have confidence, they realize that actually I'm worth more than this, right? It comes back to the fact that I understand that I'm a being that Allah has created for something much greater than just this world. If I look at myself, if I understand my worth, I realize that Allah has created me for knowledge that is of much greater worth, of power that is much greater worth. For obedience of Allah, which is the source of all perfection for the human being. And these are concepts, these are perfections, these are stations that are very high for a human being. Now these would only become a goal or an objective for a person who counts himself as important enough or worthy enough to reach those goals.
Within themselves, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and this is why, for example, you have that in Tuhaful Uqul, we have that the Imam says, "Man karumat alayhi nafsu, hanat alayhi dunya." One who counts themselves as having worth or value, they would actually not give any importance to the world.
Yeah,
right? They would count themselves very low. You're not worth enough. Like, I'm too great for you, basically.
Right.
I'm bigger than this small fame or worldly material pleasures and that kind of thing. I'm greater than all of this.
So
right?
Yeah, unimportant. So it becomes unimportant, and they become needless of the temporary world because they've valued themselves correctly.
Exactly. Yeah, they see that their goal in life and their goal of creation are much greater than these small things.
So I think that's the best. That's the best option to end our program with a tradition, also very meaningful, food for thought. Please allow us to leave for now and join you with another episode. Please do send us your suggestions, questions, and comments on englishradio@irib.ir, and also do visit our website, parstoday.com, parstoday.com. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Australia has conceded in an official report that the Great Barrier Reef's unique values as a World Heritage Site have been adversely affected by climate change. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you authored by Graham Redfern entitled Australia Demands World Heritage Experts Visit Great Barrier Reef Ahead of an Endangered List Decision. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. Australia is demanding World Heritage experts carry out a monitoring mission to the Great Barrier Reef before an international committee decides if it should be placed on a list of global sites in danger. The Australian government recently briefed international ambassadors and Paris-based delegates to UNESCO as part of lobbying efforts to keep the Great Barrier Reef off the endangered list. Australia's ambassador to UNESCO told the briefing the integrity of the entire World Heritage System, which identifies places of significance to humanity, could be compromised if the 21st Country Committee placed the reef on the list when it meets later in July. The government of Prime Minister Scott Morrison is also inviting foreign diplomats to visit the 2,300-kilometer reef off Queensland coast before the meeting. At recent briefing, which Guardian Australia has viewed, the Australian Environment Minister Susan Lee said, "We will seek a proper reactive monitoring mission before this question can be properly assessed." She said, "We seek your support in getting due process followed." Senior officials from the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, the Australian Institute of Marine Science, AIMS, and the Environment Department also spoke during the hour-long briefing. Attendees were told Australia had a purported strong track record on fighting climate change, allegedly had invested heavily in reef conservation, and its emissions were falling at record levels. But most recent falls in Australia's emissions were due to the economic slowdown caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Australia has claimed it wants its economic recovery to be driven by developments in the gas industry. Australia has not introduced a new greenhouse gas emissions target since 2015 and has been widely criticized for a lack of ambition. The country is also a major exporter of oil and gas. Australia's Paris-based ambassador to UNESCO, Megan Anderson, told the briefing the UN body had rushed its June recommendation to list the reef before any reactive monitoring mission had been carried out. Anderson claimed the rush to endanger list the Great Barrier Reef ahead of a mission, ahead of identifying a desired state of conservation, and ahead of an agreed UNESCO climate policy on World Heritage is not in the interest of the reef, and nor is it in the interest of protecting the integrity of the World Heritage System. Anderson and ambassadors from 10 other countries last month wrote a letter to UNESCO with their collective concerns over its decision-making process. The Morrison government claimed it was blindsided when UNESCO revealed its recommendation, blaming a lack of due process and politics. But UNESCO officials have flatly denied claims by Australian Environment Minister Susan Lee that it had given assurances the endangered listing would not be recommended or that the process had been politicized. Dr. Michel Rosler, director of UNESCO's World Heritage Center in Paris, has said monitoring missions are not always needed before a danger listing is recommended. UNESCO has characterized the endangered listing as a call to action that will alert the world to the plight of the reef and the importance of cutting greenhouse gas emissions. UNESCO pointed to the impacts from climate change and a lack of progress on improving water quality as areas of concern. There are 53 natural sites on the endangered list, including Florida's Everglades. Belize's Barrier Reef, part of the world's second largest reef system, was on the list from 2009 to 2018. Australian officials at the Monday, July 5th briefing said the Great Barrier Reef's main threat was climate change. But the international action on cutting emissions should center on the UN's Climate Change Convention and not the World Heritage Process. Rising ocean temperatures caused by fossil fuel burning have caused three mass coral bleachings in 2016, 2017, and 2020 since the reef was last considered by the World Heritage Committee in 2015. AIMS Chief Executive Paul Hardesty said his institute's long-term monitoring program was showing the beginnings of a widespread recovery, which was expected after no major impact since 2020 bleaching, the most widespread on record. But he told the briefing an increase in the amount of coral on reefs was driven by faster-growing species that were susceptible to bleaching and come and go fairly quickly. He said overall, the number of reefs in good condition was falling, while the number of reefs in bad condition was rising. China is the current chair of the committee and will host the virtual meeting from July 16th to 31st. A decision on the reef will likely be considered during a three-day block from July 21st to 23rd. An Australian government source said about 16 countries were represented at the briefing. In a statement to Guardian Australia, China's permanent delegation to UNESCO confirmed one of its officers had attended the briefing. As the host and chair of the committee, China was attentive to all communication and sharing of information ahead of the meeting, including the item on one of Australia's inscriptions. A spokesperson for Li said the government had extended an invitation to member states to see the reef before the meeting. The spokesperson said, "We think it is important that prior to the World Heritage Committee meeting, we offer member states that opportunity." Last week, five leading reef scientists wrote to UNESCO backing its decision to recommend the Great Barrier Reef be placed on the World Heritage in Danger list. Among the five scientists was Australian Professor Ove Hogelberg, who is the current chief scientist at the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, which in 2018 received a controversial $443 million government grant to coordinate efforts to build the reef resilience. Meanwhile, Australia has considered in an official report that the Great Barrier Reef's unique values as a World Heritage Site have been adversely affected by climate change. In the report to UNESCO's World Heritage Committee, the Queensland and federal governments say the reef is an icon under pressure with a deteriorating long-term outlook. As part of the process, the committee asked Australia to submit a comprehensive state of conservation report for the reef, the first since 2015. The report says mass coral bleaching events of 2016 and 2017, together with six tropical cyclones, flood plumes, and outbreaks of coral-eating crown of thorns starfish, have impacted the outstanding universal value of the property since the last State Party report in 2015. The report says the size of the property is becoming a less effective buffer to broad-scale and cumulative threats, primarily due to climate change. The report outlines the four criteria used to list the reef as a natural World Heritage Site in 1981. The report says components that underpin all four criteria have deteriorated. Under one criterion, covering how the ecosystem works, the report says climate change is having a detrimental impact on some critical regulating processes such as sea temperature, reef building, and recruitment, the addition of new young to the population, which means the ability of the system to bounce back is weakening. The report says limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius is widely cited as a critical threshold for the reef. The head of oceans at WWF Australia, Richard Legg, said, "This report confirms those natural values have been significantly damaged, and the World Heritage Committee needs to decide if they have been changed enough that the reef is placed on the endangered list."
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam alaikum, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batul. Welcome to the program for a better life. In our previous sessions, we asked this question, that what is a better life? Then we came to the conclusion that a better life is when a person is happy. This happiness is not the material happiness, but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? The answer is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. So how can I become a better person? In the last session, we talked about the two terms, Takhliya and Tahliya. We said that our soul is pure, but it is sometimes covered with bad traits. Just like a gem that is covered with dust and dirt. Once the dust is removed and the dirt is washed away, then the gem would shine. Similarly, once the bad traits are removed, the soul will shine. It will glow. So, now another question. How can I wash my bad traits? How can I get rid of them? In the very first session, we said, the first step is to correct myself. If I want to wash away my bad traits, if I want to become a better person, the first step is Yaghda, which is to wake up. Now wake up from what? Wake up from my deep slumber. Wake up from my deep sleep of negligence. From ghafla. Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi said that if 2 days are similar for someone, then he has made a big loss. Brothers and sisters, days here does not mean the day where the sun is out and, you know, it's warming up the day. No, no. Or the day where we say, which is the opposite of night. Over here in his saying, when he says day, it means every second. It means every moment. So each moment should be better than the previous moment. Is a step closer to Allah, is a step towards perfection. That is why the first step to discipline ourselves is to wake up, to make the best of every moment. But a person who is asleep, who is in ghafla, who is negligent, will not be aware of this loss. That is why the ulama of akhlaq call ghafla as the filth and dirt of life. Ayatullah Jawadi Amali says that man has a dahir, the one that is apparent, and a batin, the one that is hidden. The batin of the man will be manifested on the day of resurrection. On the day of judgment, some will be resurrected while their faces will be glowing. They would look beautiful. Whereas some will be resurrected while their faces will be dark and filthy. Now, the source of this filth will be their negligence, their ghafla. Surah Haqqa describes the plight of a ghafil on the day of judgment by saying, فَلَيْسَ لَهُ الْيَوْمَ هَاهُنَا حَمِيمٌ. So he has no friend here today. وَلَا تَعَامٌ إِلَّا مِنْ غِسْلِينَ. Nor any food except filth. لَا يَأْكُلُهُ إِلَّا الْقَاطِئُونَ. Which no one shall eat except the sinners. Brothers and sisters, whenever we are trapped in troubles from outside, it is because of the negligence, the ghafla from inside. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, no bird is shot by an arrow while it is glorifying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Whenever a bird or an animal is shot by an arrow, is while they are negligent.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
In another hadith, he said, the lightning does not strike the one who is glorifying Allah Azza wa Jalla. So if we make our insight strong by our faith and by remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala constantly, we will never be a prey to shaitan. When the God is down, we fall prey to shaitan. We fall prey to our nafs. Allah says, wal asr innal insana lafi khusr. By time, indeed, man is in loss. Man is in loss. Why? Because of his negligence. He has neglected himself from himself. Shaitan has no interest in a person's wealth, inheritance, status. He is after his iman, his faith. If we fall prey to shaitan, the biggest thing that attracts him is our iman, our faith. Once he traps our faith, then we will easily become gullible towards haram. We will not hesitate in sinning, but we will hesitate in doing good, God forbid. That is why we need to avoid being negligent, as it will throw us in the valley of loss. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, beware of negligence. Whoever is negligent is certainly negligent of himself, of his life. So negligence is a big loss. Let me give you an example here. It is like a traveler who is in transit and he sleeps without setting up an alarm. What will happen? He will miss the next flight, especially if it is a deep sleep. Let me give you another example. A student who did not study the whole semester, he did not turn in any assignments, he did not take any notes in the class. Why? It was because he was either playing games on his phone or texting his friends or sleeping in the class. Now what will happen to the student? Of course, he's going to fail. He asked for it. He was negligent. He did not care. So whoever is negligent is negligent to his own life. He's negligent to himself. He's incurring a great loss to himself. It is like the verse, وَمَنْ يَبْقَى فَإِنَّمَا يَبْقَلُ عَنْ نَفْسِهِ. And whoever is stingy only to himself. If someone is stingy in spending in the way of Allah, in a great cause, they are in great loss. Why? As they have not sent anything for their future abode, their hereafter. Surah Baqarah, verse 110 says, وَمَا تُقَدِّمُوا لِأَنفُسِكُمْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ تَجِدُهُ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. Any good that you send ahead for your souls, you shall find it with Allah. Whatever good that is done in the way of Allah, the reward is reserved with Him. He has promised it to us. Allah never goes against His word. So, brothers and sisters, we need to wake up from this slumber, this sleep of negligence, this sleep of ghafla, to become a better person, which in turn will lead us to a better life, inshallah. وآخر الدعواهم أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. All I need. All I need.
Africa Today.
Thousands of Ethiopians took to the streets to protest what they described as interference by the United States. During the May rallies in the capital Addis Ababa, the protesters filled the city's old stadium and the surrounding streets in a well-organized, peaceful demonstration dubbed Voices of Freedom and Sovereignty. The protesters had a clear message to the U.S. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ethiopia, my country, will proceed forward and won't go back. America should take its hands off us, and Egypt should refrain from the Nile Dam to show them that we Ethiopians will continue as a nation.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which brings you up-to-date analysis on African affairs. In our show today, we are focusing on Ethiopia's rejection of meddling by Western countries, especially the U.S., as it battles a rebel movement in the country's Tigray region. In the second segment of our program, we'll be talking about the recent parliamentary elections in Algeria as the country moves towards political stability. Now stay with us till the end of the show.
U.S. meddling in Ethiopia's Tigray. Ethiopia has been under increasing pressure from Western powers in connection with the situation in the country's Tigray region, where a rebel movement has taken up arms against the central government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered a ground and air military operation in Tigray in early November 2020 after accusing the region's then-governing party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, of orchestrating attacks on federal army camps, an allegation rejected by TPLF officials. The Prime Minister accused the TPLF of openly undermining his government.
Intent on perpetuating a culture of impunity and restoring the undue privilege they enjoyed in the past, the TPLF old guards have continuously mounted both covert and overt attempts to undermine the people of Ethiopia and our new administration.
The Ethiopian military, aided by Eritrean troops, has been battling forces loyal to the TPLF for nearly 8 months. According to some reports, Western countries, including the United States, are backing the TPLF rebels. The conflict has killed thousands of people and many more, triggering an immense humanitarian crisis. The United States has seen the conflict in Tigray as an opportunity to meddle in Ethiopia's internal affairs and has announced sanctions against this Horn of Africa nation. Ethiopia